Pastor Steve Thomas is pastor of Huron Baptist Church in Michigan, south of Detroit, kind of between Detroit and Toledo, Ohio. He's been there for a number of years, and he has done some extensive studying in the topic of the openness of God. If that's a new topic to you, it probably isn't to your people. One way or another, it's creeping in. And so let me encourage you, this will be a great workshop, a challenging workshop. And one thing he's going to address is how it is sneaking into our pulpits and to our pews. Because we are indeed to keep away the wolves. And as this error sneaks in, it's our responsibility to see it sneaking in and to cut it off. And so Pastor Steve Thomas will come now with a workshop, Openness of God.
Thank you, brother. I'm delighted to be with you here today. You can open your notebooks to page 3 to find the notes for this particular workshop. Before we begin, I was wondering, let's see, I rode with Dr. Williams. Dr. Williams, do you think that this pulpit will fit in our trunk on the way back? All right. We actually have a monumental task before us here this afternoon. You'll notice a footnote at the bottom of page 3. The first section of your notes there was actually prepared for a presentation that was done at the annual FBF meeting at First Baptist Church of Troy a few years ago. I wasn't able to get through those notes then. And Pastor Willequit has asked me to add an emphasis that I've put in as an addendum on whether or not this matter of open theism presents a threat to fundamentalism. That's really where our focus wants to be today. So we're going to try to do an overview very quickly of open theism and then make a mad dash to page 20 of your notes and try to address the topic that that Pastor Willequit has asked me to deal with. And we, obviously, in the amount of time that we have, we'll only be able to scratch the surface on some of this. State there at the beginning of your notes that our understanding of providence depends in part on the answer to this question. What does God know, and when did He know it? Let's pause there for just a moment. If we want to understand God's relationship to His universe, and how He works in this universe, then we're going to have to do some theological study on the subject of the omniscience of God. Does God know, and when did He know it? I've mentioned there that all of Christendom has answered this question with a single voice throughout church history, that God has exhaustive knowledge of all things, past, present, and future. God's omniscience is more than that, but for our purposes today, it is certainly that. It is exhaustive knowledge of all things, past, present, and future. And yet during the past 20 years, a new movement has arisen to challenge this foundational belief. This movement was originally called free will theism until classic Arminians began to object because they wanted to distance themselves from this new movement, even though it's a subset of Arminianism. They said, you can't call yourself free will theists because we're free will theists. We already have the copyright on that title. And so it became called open theism, and we'll discuss why that is in just a few moments. When I was a child, I was taught a little simple prayer. For years as a small child, I prayed, God is great, God is good. Little did I know at that time that I was actually expressing profound theology as I prayed. You see, theologians divide the attributes of God into two categories. There are those attributes that we call His greatness. They're characterized by infinity. He is without limitation in certain attributes. So when we say that he is omnipotent, we mean that he is without limitation in his power. These are attributes that belong to him alone. Then there are the attributes of God's goodness. They are characterized by his holiness. And these, unlike attributes of greatness, can be shared with his image bearers. Attributes of goodness seem to take center stage in the preaching, the teaching of many. The omniscience of God is, of course, an attribute of God's greatness. We say that he is without limitation in his knowledge. And this new movement of open theism has served to undercut this attribute of his greatness without really stopping to realize that in so doing, they also undercut the attributes of his goodness. For you see, if God is incapable of accomplishing his purposes and his will, then his knowledge of his goodness is utterly meaning to us. So this new movement is attacking the doctrines of his greatness and thus undermining the doctrines of his goodness. There are a number of proponents of open theism that I'd like to introduce you to. The chief theologian of open theism is Clark Pinnock. If you've read any of his writings through the years, you'll find that his theological career is all over the map. In fact, following him is like trying to follow chicken tracks. He has moved all over the place. However, most people aren't aware of Clark Pinnock or John Sanders or some of the other more influential writers. However, there is one man who has really carved out a niche for open theism in the popular realm of evangelicalism. Chief proponent is a man named Greg Boyd. Until recently, he served as professor at Bethel Seminary. He's also a pastor in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area with a large church. It's my understanding that he attracts as many as 3,000 people each week to hear him proclaim this new viewpoint. He's a popular author. He has authored such books as God of the Possible, which, by the way, if you're interested in seeing the implications of open theism from their viewpoint, that is probably the one book to buy. It is very readable. It is making this movement very popular. God of the Possible. He's also written Letters from a Skeptic, letters corresponding with his father who is a skeptic, and then God at War. And as we give a brief summary of open theism, I'm going to draw heavily from his book, God of the Possible, subtitled Biblical Introduction to the Open View of God. Now, with all that said, let me answer the question, what is open theism? Very simply put, it is the belief that God cannot know the future choices of free creatures. Not only can he not know the future choices of free creatures, he cannot know any of the consequences of those choices. Now you stop and think for a moment. How much is there in human history that neither involves the choices of people or the consequences of those choices? I suppose the open theist would tell us that God knows some things about the rotation of the planets, but he knows virtually nothing of human history. Now, the open theist is called an open theist specifically because the future is open to God in their theological construct. Nothing is settled. Nothing is determined. God has not planned the future. He only knows the past and the present, but the future is completely open to him. And so he has ordained the rotation of the planets, but he has ordained nothing that pertains to your life. Nothing whatsoever. Now, the open theists still insist that they believe in the omniscience of God. They say, we have not jettisoned orthodox theology. We believe in the omniscience of God. How is that? Well, they say that omniscience means that God knows all things that are knowable. And until you make a choice, there is nothing for God to know. So they say God knows all things, but within that narrow definition. For them, future events that depend on our choices are not knowable even to God. Now, I want you to think with me for a few moments about the implications of that. I'm getting a glare on the clock up there, so I'm going to take off my watch and lay it here. And of course, you are very well aware of what it means when a preacher lays his watch down so that he can see it. You aware of what that means? Absolutely nothing. But don't fear, I have a calendar on my watch, so we'll be okay. All right. When you think about this new view of the attributes of God's greatness, I think that you can immediately see some of the startling interrelated implications. Let me just quickly survey some of these. Open theists, first of all, have created a God who must learn moment by moment. Now, open theism is a subset of classic Arminian theology. Historically, Arminianism has affirmed the exhaustive foreknowledge of God, and yet they deny that God has worked to determine the future. They have created a theological construct in which they are forced to say that there is an antinomy here. There's an apparent contradiction, although we know that it isn't a real contradiction, but we have no way of explaining it other than saying it's an antinomy. However, we have open theists who say, let's do away with the logical inconsistencies here. And let's be consistent. And in order to be consistent, we're going to have to do one of two things. We will have to either change our view of God or change our view of man. Because of the depravity of man, who wins? It's always man. So they changed their view of God and left man's autonomy alone. And in so doing, they created a God who must learn moment by moment. God acts as an observer who knows because he sees, not because he ordains. He knows because he watches, not because he is planned. Open theists have also created a God who is continually at risk. Listen to this quote from John Sanders, who wrote the book, The God Who Risks. And in describing the fall of man, he says, God in freedom establishes the context in which a loving and trusting relationship between himself and humans can develop. God expects that it will, and there is no reason to suspect that any other possibility will come about. A break in the relationship does not seem plausible considering all the good that God has done, yet the possibility has been introduced by God's commandment. Here we have the sovereign risk. In this workshop later this afternoon, we're going to ask the question, what do we mean by sovereignty? Rightly defined, I want you to understand that the expression sovereign risk is an oxymoron. You cannot have sovereign risk. But they have created a God who is continually at risk. God has been cast in the role of a respondent rather than an actor in the universe, as far as his relationship to us is concerned. And so in this theological construct, salvation is reduced to a plan B for God. Jesus Christ went to the cross because things did not work out as God anticipated they would. He put himself at risk, knowing that there was a possibility that man would fall, but he didn't expect it. And so salvation becomes plan B. However, Boyd remarkably suggests that a God subject to risk is worthy of greater glory because of his infinite resourcefulness in creating a plan B or a plan C ad infinitum. That is why they have coined a new term. God is not only omnipotent, omnipresent, and omniscient according to their definition, but God is also omnicompetent because he can respond quickly and wisely. They've created a God who is continually at risk, and they've also created a God who merely guesses about the future and is sometimes wrong. According to open theism, God does not make infallible decisions regarding the future. He guesses. As one author has put it, suppose now that we need to pray our bookie who art in heaven. He just guesses about the future. Well, I could go on with this brief description. The question immediately comes to mind, what is the appeal of this sort of a vision of God? What is the appeal of open theism? Well, you need to understand that open theists believe that they have really taken a giant leap forward in solving the problem of evil. You know, the problem of evil to the question of why evil exists in a world created by an all-knowing God who's never taken by surprise, and an all-powerful God who can always do as he pleases. And so evil didn't creep up on him, and he was able to change it. So how do we explain the existence of evil created in a universe created by a God who is also good? I don't have a clue about the answer to that question. And that is why we call it the problem of evil. No one has the answer to that question. But the open theist says we've taken a huge leap forward. Because when we look at evil within the world now, we can do as Greg Boyd did, telling his agnostic father that when Adolf Hitler committed monstrous crimes against humanity, it was because God couldn't foresee it coming. And so God is now given plausible deniability. I really feel your pain, very Clintonian. I feel your pain, but I could not act. I didn't foresee it coming. They seek to stress the relational significance between the interaction of God and man. They believe that there can be no significant, genuine relational interaction between human beings and a God who has planned all things. They try to clarify the purpose of prayer. But probably the most appealing facet of this is the fact that they say that their view enables them to apply normal hermeneutics consistently. Greg Boyd says, "The open view is rooted in the conviction that the passages that constitute the motif of future openness should be taken just as literally as the passages that constitute future determinism." What he means by that is we have a set of texts. To be exact, there are 105 of them. We have a set of texts that speak of God changing his mind or learning. And if we're going to take a literal approach to interpreting Scripture, then you have to take those passages at face value. Probably the key text for them is Genesis chapter 22 and verse 12, one of these 105 so-called proof texts. You remember the context. Abraham is on top of the mount, ready to sacrifice Isaac. And suddenly he hears the words, "Do not lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." Now what the open theist says is that the section of that verse, "Now I know that you fear God," means that God knows Abraham's heart because he saw the deed. And therefore, God learned. Now, this is actually a sleight of hand trick. If Abraham had the knife poised and was about to plunge it into his son, how could God have truly known what was in his heart if he stopped short of fulfilling the deed? Furthermore, before he went up on the mountain, there was ample evidence of what was in his heart. He didn't need to take him up on the mountain, because before he went up on the mountain, he turned to the servants and said, "The lad and I are going to go worship, and then we will return." And the author of the book of Hebrews took that to mean that Abraham believed that the promises of God were so sure that if he obeyed and slew his son, God would raise him from the dead. So before he ever ascended the mountain, there was ample evidence of his faith. So the act on top of the mountain was meaningless as far as informing God of what was in the heart of Abraham. There's more to be said about that passage. I wish we had the time. I want to suggest to you that we need to view passages such as that in terms of a figure of speech called an anthropomorphism. Passages such as Genesis 22:12 contain anthropomorphic language, a word that comes from anthropos, meaning man, and morphe, meaning form. It's a figure of speech that portrays God with human traits or in the form of a man. And this is necessary in certain contexts for two reasons. It's because God is transcendent. He is beyond the universe. In fact, we define the universe as all that is not God. And consequently, we understand that God is timelessly eternal. Now, let me ask you how you describe with precision a God who exists beyond the space-time continuum as he interacts with human beings. I can't even put my mind around such a concept. How do we describe it? And so the authors of the scriptures sometimes refer to God in terms that we can understand, ascribing human traits to God. We call this anthropomorphic language. What took place in Genesis chapter 22 and verse 12 was essentially God saying, "I am with you and I see." And the real benefit of Genesis 22:12 was for Abraham and not for God. Let me back up a couple of chapters here and show you an interpretive hot potato that open theists can't handle if they're going to say, let's be consistent in our interpretation. Genesis chapter 18, verse 20. Here is one of the exegetical and hermeneutical problems that we find in open theism. Genesis 18. We read, "Then the Lord said, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great, and their sin so grievous, that I will go down and see if what they have done is as bad as the outcry that has reached me. If not, I will know." Now let's apply the standard of interpretation that the open theists have set forth and take this with frank literalness. The first thing that we see is that if the open theist applies his literal hermeneutic to this verse, he must deny that God knows all things past and present. Not just the future, but past and present. Because he says, "I'm going to go, and if I've heard an outcry, and I'm going to go see if it is true." Furthermore, if we apply it literally, we not only have to deny that he knows all things, not just the future, but also the past and the present, but we also have to deny his omnipresence, because he says, "I'm going to go down and see." If I could recommend one book to you on the side of the opponents of open theism, It's God's Lesser Glory, written by Bruce Ware. I heard Bruce Ware say that, or describe a situation. See, he used to teach with some of these men, Greg Boyd, John Sanders. Described a situation where he approached John Sanders, author of the book where he described sovereign risk. And he took this verse from Genesis chapter 18 to Sanders and said, "Would you explain this to me?" And every time he sees him through the years, and occasionally he even emails him, "Would you explain this verse to me?" And every time he gets the same response, "I'll get back to you on that." It's a hot potato they cannot handle. There are also other problems. They are incapable of correlating biblical prophecy, and it even borders on the dishonest. In describing Jesus' prediction that Peter would deny Jesus three times, Greg Boyd says this: "We only need to believe that God the Father knew and revealed to Jesus one very predictable aspect of Peter's character. Anyone who knew Peter's character perfectly could have predicted that under certain highly pressured circumstances that God could easily orchestrate, he would act just the way he did." Now, wait a minute. God, who couldn't know what was in Abraham's heart back at the mountain in Genesis 22, knew so much about Peter that he could predict that Peter would deny Jesus not once, but three times? And would you notice he says God could easily orchestrate the circumstances in which this would take place. Well, again, let's pause here for a moment. Open theists say that God can't know anything about your future choices. Now, I can understand how God could nudge the rooster to get it to crow at the right time, but he can't nudge the girl at the door or the soldier at the campfire. And what has happened here is this man, Greg Boyd, in just utter dishonesty, has failed to explain the prophecy of the three denials, and in so doing has stumbled into a twofold inconsistency. I've just described the fact that God could not orchestrate the situation, and if God did, doesn't that make him somehow culpable for Peter's sin, at least in Greg Boyd's system of theology? It's utter interpretive dishonesty. For the sake of time, let me give you a quick survey of the biblical data on God's foreknowledge. I have, in your outline, stated that open theism creates a God of diminished glory. I suggest to you that the Bible reveals a God of infinite glory. There is a book that is being produced right now. It should be published within the next year, written by a man named Stephen Roy, or if he happens to be from Canada, I don't know his origin, that would be Stephen Waugh. And he is a graduate of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, completed his doctoral dissertation on the subject of the omniscience of God. And the interesting thing about his doctoral dissertation was that he went through the scriptures and identified every passage that has anything to do with the foreknowledge of God, and he categorized them. Now, people are shocked when they find out that there are 105 passages that seem to say that God changes his mind or learns. But let's look at a summary of Stephen Roy's study on the foreknowledge of God. He concluded that there are 164 texts that explicitly teach or affirm God's foreknowledge. There are 271 texts that explicitly teach or affirm other aspects of God's omniscience, for example, knowledge of past, present, or possible states of affairs. There are 128 texts that offer predictions of what God will do through nature, and 1,893 texts that state predictively that God will do something or other through human beings. There are 1,474 texts that state predictively what human beings will do apart from God directly acting in or through them, and there are 622 texts that state predictively what unbelievers will do or have happened to them. There are 143 texts that affirm God's sovereign control over human choices. Or, to put it another way, over against their 105 so-called proof texts, there are 4,695 total verses that affirm the classic view of divine omniscience. Within the next year, you really need to look on the bookshelves for Stephen Roy's book on the foreknowledge of God. I think that it is going to be a monumental work. Greg Boyd says that the foreknowledge of God is a peripheral issue. We shouldn't make a big deal out of this perverted, heretical view that they've set forth. I would challenge you to read Isaiah chapter 40 through chapter 48. I would like to have the time to survey some key passages there this morning or this afternoon. We do not have the time. But I would challenge you to read them on your own. And in those chapters, you will find the following truths taught. I think that that section of Scripture is a test case for whether or not God's exhaustive foreknowledge is peripheral. You see, the situation is this. God is dealing with His people and saying, "You have gone whoring after idols. Well, let's bring those idols forth. I challenge them. Let's see who the real God is." And you know the key issue that He used in the challenge? Whether or not they knew the future. In the very beginning of this section, we're ushered into the presence of greatness beyond our imagination. Read Isaiah 40. God, who measures the heavens with the span of His hand. How far away is the nearest star? 4 light years? And we have a God who measures the heavens with the span of His hand. I illustrate the greatness of God this way to my people. Not too long ago, I was standing right in the surf of the Arabian Sea. Not a particularly comforting place to be these days. But I was standing in the surf of the Arabian Sea, reached down, picked up a handful of water. Do you know what happened to the water level of the oceans when I did that? Absolutely nothing, but Isaiah 40 says, He holds the waters in His hands. In Isaiah 40, we're ushered into the presence of unimaginable greatness. And He says, "Who has ever informed me? Who has ever added to my knowledge? All of the nations, with all of their might and with all of their wisdom, are but a drop in the bucket. They are less than nothing on the scales." And then He launches into this great discussion of the fact that He is God because He has determined the future. If you read through those chapters, you'll find that God neither depends on nor welcomes our say-so. Open theists say that the significance of prayer is that we give God our say-so, and so He can act. We find in those chapters that the exercise of foreknowledge affirms God's claim of deity. He says, "I'm God because I know the future." We find in those chapters that God's glory is bound up with His foreknowledge. We find in those chapters that foreknowledge demonstrates God's exclusive claim to deity. He is God because He knows the future. And He says, that makes me the only God, which must mean that there is a corollary truth. He knows the future because He has planned the future. And there's only one God who can do that. We find there that He freely determines the future and that His determination of the future is exhaustive. He says, I planned the end from the beginning. In fact, my plan extends to the realm of nature, for I call a bird from a bird to do my will. And my plan extends to the realms of humanity because I summon a man to do my will. And whatever I have determined, that will I do. One of the amazing features of those chapters is that He foretells the coming of Cyrus. 300 years before Cyrus was born. Think of the contingencies. Think of the choices. One man, so ugly he can't marry, and the whole plan is out the door. I'm being facetious. But think of the contingencies, the choices, that over 300 years there would be an unfolding of history so that one set of parents had a son at the right time and named him Cyrus. Open theism, because of its inability to account for prophecy, reveals its true motivation. They aren't concerned about resolving the problem of evil. They aren't concerned about deepening our personal relationship with God. They aren't concerned about giving significance to prayer half as much as they're concerned about establishing and maintaining their own autonomy. Because their position flies in the face of the whole of Scripture. Note your conclusion there. Page should be 19 or 18. Yes, 19. Page 20, top of page 20. I'm sorry, bottom of page 19. Conclusion. What's at stake with this? If I can make up the word, the very godness of God is at stake. The very godness of God. What it means to be God is at stake when we fail to define omniscience in terms that include exhaustive, determinative foreknowledge. Technically, foreknowledge doesn't determine, but He foreknows because He has determined. There are many practical implications of this. Top of page 20. The all-knowing one brings comfort to the heart of those who trust Him. Open theism has undercut the confidence that we have as we face the difficulties of day-to-day living. And yet, we who believe that God knows all things past, present, and future exhaustively can rest in the knowledge that our distresses never take Him by surprise and that they have eternal purpose. I received a phone call one day that my nephew was traveling down the road on a motorcycle. A lady in a delivery van saw him, later said, I thought I could beat him. Pulled out in front of him and traveling about 50 miles an hour, he hit her broadside, flew in the air over a billboard. And while he was in surgery, the doctors told my sister, that she needed to begin preparing for his funeral. God, in His grace, has allowed him to live. But I heard of the accident called the hospital waiting room. And all I could say to my sister, who I knew was in great anguish, was, Nancy, how are you? As long as I live, I'll never forget the words. She said, Steve, I really am all right. Because I still believe that Romans 8:28 is true. And the open theists have undercut that confidence that we have that God is at work. Nothing takes him by surprise, and all of our distresses have eternal purpose. There's a flip side in terms of practical application of this. We need to understand that the all-knowing one should strike fear in the hearts of those who do not trust him. They cannot hide from God. Now, in the next 10 or 15 minutes, that brings us to the point that Brother Willequit wants me to emphasize. So you look there on page 20, and we see we have an addendum very quickly. The question is open theism a threat within fundamentalism? See, it is so radically different from the God proclaimed in fundamental churches that we might very legitimately ask, if this is just a discussion, to tickle the fancies of those who like to interact about theology in the halls of academia. On the surface, it seems to be no real threat, but I would suggest to you that on closer examination, it may be that we will begin to suffer casualties because of open theism. Probably not in an open way, pardon the pun, at first. But I do believe that it will see growing sympathies within some quarters of fundamentalism. And I believe that there will be a growing number of those within our pews who will wonder if maybe we shouldn't open the door to this heresy. I'm going to suggest to you that it will be a growing threat within fundamentalism for four reasons. I won't be able to cover all of these in the time that we have, but you can read through the notes. I believe that it will be a growing threat because there is a common foundation. Some quarters of fundamentalism have a foundation in common with open theism, and that common foundation is Arminian theology. Second commonality is a common focus. In some quarters of fundamentalism, there is a focus upon God, on man rather than God. There are also common cultural influences at work. And finally, there are some common assumptions. With regard to the common foundation, I've mentioned there in your notes that Arminian theology rejects the sovereignty of God and Arminian theology rejects the total depravity of man. I wish I had time to develop that here this afternoon, but let me mention to you that I think that there are some roots of Arminian fundamentalism that we need to consider. For your own edification, maybe study some of the historical alliances that have been forged. I believe that the roots of Arminian fundamentalism go back to revivalism, not revival, but revivalism. I think that the roots of Arminian fundamentalism go back to the fundamentalist modernist controversy. As we saw 100 years ago, a great threat, and men of God from various backgrounds held hands, joined hands in order to unite to fight the common threat. And it made strange theological bedfellows. It used to be that Calvinism and Arminianism, while thankful for the gospel being preached in each camp, were content organizationally to go their own ways. But over a period of time, as a result, in my opinion, of these two cultural emphases, there was an alliance formed, and now we have an amalgamation that has taken place. There's some current expressions of Arminian fundamentalism. I find that there's great animosity within some quarters of fundamentalism toward the doctrines of grace and the sovereignty of God. There's a well-known book that has a chapter describing hindrances to authentic evangelism. That well-known book lists one hindrance. That one hindrance is an overemphasis on Calvinism, and yet it says nothing about an overemphasis on Arminianism. Nothing. Now, gentlemen, I don't know what circles you've been moving in, but in the meetings that I've been to through the years, you can fling bricks all day in most of our meetings without hitting a single hyper-Calvinist. But what about those who are rabid in their Arminianism? There's confusion. You talk about these two terms, Calvinism and Arminianism. Most people in the pew don't have a clue what you're talking about. In fact, there has developed this mindset that says we have two groups. You have the one group, hyper-Calvinism, and then there is one other group on this side called biblicist. Those are the only two groups. Now, is there anyone here who would not claim to be a biblicist? There has never been a more meaningless term. It's confusion. There's a common focus, man rather than God. Arminianism within fundamentalism upholds the autonomy of man at the expense of the sovereignty of God and emphasizes soteriology over doxology. I was in a meeting a number of years ago where I heard a pastor who was conducting a workshop in this conference say, I hear people talk about the fact that we need to glorify God. That's what I mean by doxology. I hear people talking about the fact that we need to glorify God. Folks, we'll have time to do that when we get to heaven. We need to be winning souls now. What do you do with such a man? I'll tell you what we in fundamentalism do. We make him the president of well-known Bible college. There are common cultural influences. I've taken this, borrowed this from William Davis, who wrote Why Open Theism is Flourishing Now in an excellent book. You might want to add this to your library, Beyond the Bounds, Open Theism and the Understanding of Biblical Christianity. He says that there are common cultural influences that gave rise to the popularity of open theism. And as I look at the cultural influences that he describes, I see them in my church. He says that one of the cultural influences is suspicion of authority. Notice that he talks about the influence of Nietzsche, which is, by the way, a very real influence. I can go up to the Starbucks in Dearborn, Michigan and sit and watch some of the college students walking by. And about every time I go there, I see someone wearing a T-shirt with a picture of Nietzsche. Nietzsche taught that authority rests on power and serves only to maintain power structures. So there's suspicion of any kind of authority. So in my church, through the years, particularly over in Ford country, you have the labor management mentality. The person in the pew is labor, I'm management, and everyone knows that management must have something to hide. Some of you live in areas where conspiracy theorists abound and they invade our churches. I was teaching a class at a at a Bible college not too long ago and sat down to talk with some area pastors, and I was hearing them talk about the government in terms I had never heard anyone to say, referring to our government. I mean, here were some bona fide conspiracy theorists, and they were pastors, and the conversation soon turned on to how they could get unregistered weapons. And you've got some of them in your church, I'll guarantee. If you don't have them, then you've got the deacon who believes that the church is run by a representative government. He's the representative of this group. I'm simply saying, in a very practical way, we've all got suspicion of authority rampant in our churches. Open theism plays to suspicion of authority. It emasculates God and renders His authority neutral. Another common cultural influence, you can read them, infatuation with liberty, self-explanatory, impatience with mystery. People don't like loose ends. Explain the relationship between divine sovereignty and human responsibility. In Romans chapter 9, Paul explained it. And if you read through the passage, the question that he puts on the lips of an objector, remember the question? Then why does God hold me responsible? That question only makes sense if he's arguing for the absolute, deterministic sovereignty of God. So they ask the question, do you remember Paul's response? He doesn't tie up the loose ends. He simply says, who are you to talk back to God? Pragmatism in community simply means people love to keep the peace. Let's not do battle over these little nitpicky theological issues. You get the idea. Finally, you've got some common assumptions. Let me list those very quickly. I believe that most people in the pew already believe that God looks through the tunnel of time. And when you embrace that theory of foreknowledge, it doesn't matter whether it's simple prescience, he looks through the tunnel of time, or what is called Molinism, and if you don't know what that is, I can best explain it as God looks through a hypothetical tunnel of time. Either way, he's looking through time to see what will happen, and these people have a God who at least at one point in eternity past learned. He didn't determine. He looked to see what would happen. Most people believe that. Most people sitting in the pews today believe that God needs our say-so to act. And so they believe that prayer changes God's mind. Or they say things like, let God. Now, I've got a problem already. Anytime a sentence begins with human beings letting God do anything, we're slipping toward heresy. But let God be Lord of your life. I've got news for you. He is already Lord. You simply need to acknowledge it. Most people believe that there are elements outside of history, or elements of history that are outside of God's control. When a relative was killed in a car wreck, my father-in-law, who is a deacon in a Baptist church, declared, well, you see, this person violated natural law and God didn't have anything to do with her death. Of course, the bottom line in all of this is that people will do anything to uphold autonomous libertarian freedom. That's what this is all about. And in 30 seconds, I want to ask the question, what shall we do? I've made some suggestions there for you on your sheet. I'll summarize them this way. Two things. We need to raise our expectations for the theological training of our people. Our people can understand this if we will do the work to teach them. Our people can interact with this. We need to warn them of the dangers of this false teaching and every other false teaching that comes down the pike. Let's not be simplistic. Let's be thorough in our training. Let's not speak generally. You can talk to people about those who want to say God doesn't know the future, and they say, oh, that's terrible, but you bring it home. Do you believe that God looks through the tunnel of time? Let's be specific. Then we need to sterilize the seedbed of compromise. We do this by addressing the pertinent issues in a direct and relevant fashion, upholding the sovereignty of God and the inability of man, creating a doxological perspective in ministry, exposing the infiltration of godless culture in our churches, and teaching and preaching the attributes of God with their practical implications. I thank you for your patience today. This was an awful lot for the short.